Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
That's so lovely. My name is Stephanie Brandenburg, and I'm a member of the Board of Trustees of this congregation, and I welcome you today. We welcome all, regardless of age, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, religious background, or political affiliation, factors that can separate people in the larger culture. If this is your first time visiting us, please join us after the service for refreshments and conversation. Feel free to take any brochures on UUism that are on the wall near the front door. Please sign our guest book, which is out in the entry hall. People with name tags and blue dots are members of our congregation and will be glad to chat with you about their experiences in the fellowship. Because our services may differ from week to week, we encourage you to come back a few more times to get a flavor of our services and our community. Now is the time to turn off all cell phones. Parents of small children are reminded that we have child care and religious education classes, which I believe start today. Yes. If you choose to keep your children with you in the worship room, please respect our need for this to be a time of quiet and peaceful reflection. And also, please remember that children in the Sunday school need to be supervised at all times. A few announcements for today. There is the committee sign-up fair. There will be representatives from each committee. If you haven't thought about it, please do. We have a lot of work to do and a lot of good things to prepare for this year and follow through on, and we do need the help of everybody. So whether it's making a phone call or participating in any way you think you may be of interest, there's nothing too small or insignificant, so please speak with some of the committee reps out after services today. We also want to thank Peg Clark and all those volunteers who helped make yesterday's Autumn Bazaar fundraiser a very wonderful success. We raised over $1,800 yesterday. And today, in the back of the room, you noticed some books. They are available for sale. And if anybody has an affiliation with any kind of local library or think you may be able to donate these books that are left over, please see Peg about arranging for that. A few more announcements. Reverend Rebecca Sala has some announcements, and then Reverend Abigail Stockman has some announcements. Welcome all.
Good morning. Good morning. Like Stephanie said, teaching starts today, but I wanted to tell you that I've submitted my resignation as Director of Religious Education. The position I took as Community Relations Officer at the Domestic Violence Crisis Center is much more than I thought it would be, and I cannot juggle both. And while I've told everybody this for quite a while, I wasn't sure what would happen. I just wanted to let everyone know, and we're working with the board and with Reverend Stockman to make sure that REACH maintains the same momentum. And I just have to thank every one of you for the past 2 years. It's been an extraordinary experience. My last Sunday will be October 16th. So thank you all.
And I just have a few brief announcements. If anybody would like to gather this morning just to talk for a moment about Rebecca's resignation, I invite you to come back into the sanctuary at 11:45, and we can sit for half an hour and just have some discussion and sharing. We'll do that right up here. My office hours this week, I will be in on Tuesday from 9:30 until noon, and then from 3 till 5, and on Wednesday from 10 to 2. If you need to meet with me, please give me a call, and I'm happy to set up a time for appointment. Those aren't my only times I'm willing to be here. Those are just the times I am definitely going to be here this week. In October, on the first Wednesday in October, we will be having a short Vespers service at 7 p.m. And I invite anyone to come and join us. That should last for about a half an hour of quiet reflection, prayer, music, and just generally reconnecting with yourself in another time in the week as well as Sunday morning. And please listen for the announcements coming soon for some adult religious education programs. So pay attention, watch your email, listen for Sunday announcements. And the announcements. We will now have our prelude. The words of Richard Gilbert. We meet on holy ground, for that place is holy, where lives touch, love moves, hope stirs. How much we need this moment before the eternal, the time to be in reverence before the ultimate, the pause that renews, the interlude that refreshes, the space that gives us room to be. We meet on holy ground, brought into being as life encounters life, as personal histories merge into the communal story, as we take on the pride and pain of our companions, as separate selves become community. How desperate is our need for one another, our silent beckoning to our neighbors, our invitations to share life and death together, our welcome into the lives of those we meet, and their welcome into our own. May our souls capture this treasured time, and may our spirits celebrate our meeting in this time and in this space. For we meet on holy ground. Please greet your neighbor in the spirit of openness and wonder, with a curiosity about how their spirit, their being, and their becoming is today. I invite you to rise in body or in spirit for our hymn, our chalice lighting, and our unison affirmation. I'd like to invite our teachers, if they are feeling up to it, to come and light our chalice. to lead us in our chalice light?
May the wine of this flame illuminate our lives and the strivings of the Spirit. May it heal this understanding and strengthen the love.
Let us join together in our affirmation.
Love is the doctrine of this fellowship. The quest for truth is the sacrament, and service is the prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek truth and love, to serve humanity in fellowship. In the end, that all souls shall grow into harmony. Let us be covenant with one another.
And if the teachers could stay up for our litany of dedication for them. You will find it as an insert in your order of service. This morning, we wish to thank you for your commitment to this church, to our shared values, and especially to our children and youth. You have accepted the responsibility of helping our children and youth grow and develop within our community. The enthusiasm you show toward them, this fellowship, and our Unitarian Universalist movement will help them as they develop their own spiritual identities. We wish you to know that we acknowledge the responsibility you have accepted and respect the commitment you have made. Our lives are better for it. If the parents could read. Teachers, wake them. Our lives are better for it. Teachers and advisors.
Parents, we thank you for entrusting your children to us. And children and youth, we too are grateful for your sharing of your lives with us. We ask your support in this endeavor. Be here when we need help. Listen to us when we need your ear.
Our lives are better for it.
Children and youth.
Thank you for listening to us. Valuing our input.
Our lives are better for it. Teachers, thank you for sharing yourselves with our children and youth.
We honor the role you have within our community. We know that this is not something you can do alone. We are all teachers and we will strive to remember that. We are all here to support and help you.
This is the beginning of the new year. We are all part of this one community, children and adults alike. May we grow and be enriched by our time together. Our lives are better for it. You may be seated. If we could sing, please sing the children out now. Thank you.
Harmony arises. In the spirit of harmony, the offering is a sacrament of the free fellowship. It is supported by the voluntary generosity of all who join with us. The offering will now be given and received in grateful appreciation of our shared hopes and values. Please be generous. I have two readings this morning, and I realize that by a fluke of planning, this is the third week in a row that my sermon and or the readings address some traditionally Christian and Jewish and biblical themes. So I ask for your graciousness if that is if that's a sore point with you. I can only offer the possibility that we listen to this with an openness of curiosity and wonder beyond the words or beliefs that we may not share to the spirit that can inform and enlarge us as Unitarian Universalists. The first reading, called Holy Food, from Christianity Rediscovered by Vincent Donovan. I came across another extraordinary custom of the Maasai. Sometimes the sin occurs not between individuals, but among groups in the same community. One family might offend another family, and disruption sets in on the whole community. This can be disastrous to a nomadic type community who must have unity above all else for the sake of their herding together and moving together and for their common defense against enemies. A disruption like this can rupture the whole agreement or pact or covenant on which the community first came together and on which it remains together. If at all possible, both the offending and the offended family must be brought back together by an act of forgiveness sought and bestowed. So, at the behest of the total community, both families prepare food. The word for food in Maasai is enda. But this will be a special kind of food called enda sinyati, meaning holy food. This holy food is brought to the center of the village by the two families, accompanied by the rest of the community, encouraging both families all along the way. There, in the center of the village, the food is exchanged between the two families, each family accepting the food prepared by the other. Then the holy food is eaten by both families, and when it is, forgiveness comes. And the people say that a new asotua has begun. Asotua is the word for covenant or pact or testament. A new testament of forgiveness is brought about by the exchange of holy food. What can one say? The second reading is pertains to halakha, which is, and I hope I've said that correctly, which is Jewish law. This is A Rabbi Reflects on the Jewish Law by David Hartman from Halakha in Contemporary Jewish Religious Thought. Halakha revolves around two poles, the legal, that is, specified and detailed rules of behavior, and the relational, that is, the yearning to give expression to the intimate covenantal relationship between God and Israel. Both of these poles have shaped halachic thought and practice. The legal pole, the tendency to fix formulations for conduct, may reflect the yearning and need of human beings for order and predictability in relationships. the way is given. The task of the covenantal Jew is merely to respond. On the other hand, the covenantal pole emphasizes that halakha is not only a formal system concerned with the rules of procedure, but also an expressive system grounded in the love relationship symbolized by God's invitation to Israel to become his covenantal community. The understanding of halakha as a covenantal relational experience guards against the mistaken notion that a dynamic living relationship with God can be structured exclusively by fixed and permanent rules. The need for order must not be at the expense of spontaneity, personal passion, novelty, and surprise. The perennial problem that one faces in living by halakha is how to prevent the covenantal relational pole from being obscured by the massive, seemingly self-sufficient legal framework. Thus ends the readings, and I do promise to tie them together in the sermon. This is the time of sharing of personal joys and sorrows of our lives, deepening the connections of this community, of one to the other. If you have a joy or sorrow, please come forward if you would like, light a candle, and if you wish, you may share aloud with the gathered community.
Hi, I'm Mira Rentschner Kelly, and this is a joy for, I think, what I would say was a very successful tag sale and book sale yesterday. A lot of people worked very hard, but I want to give particular recognition to Peggy Clark, who is home resting after working her butt off, not only organizing it, but being here all day, Thursday and Friday and Saturday, and she did an incredible job. Raised about $1,800.
You know how to do it. We're lighting a candle of joy. I'm Carla Casisto, and this is my daughter, Katie Stokes, and she's home for the weekend, and I'm really joyful that she's back here reconnecting with the fellowship.
I'd also like to have this candle be of sorrow for my rabbit that died and my cats that ran away. Also, my soulmate and the love of my life is nowhere to be found, and I hope that someday we can find each other again.
Welcome, Katie. This is a candle for the choir. That was a beautiful, beautiful invocation. And we don't thank you guys enough for the time you take to sing and the joy you bring to all of us.
Hi, my name is Tim Hart. I have been beset recently by some tests, personal tests with familial illness and things like that. But nevertheless, this is a candle of joy. I have positioned myself in life where I'm able to face these tests with and be regarded as someone that can be relied upon. I also, as I stand in this room, this is the room I got married in, on July 30th, to Kathy Gallagher, and I am very joyful that I have her in my life to help me shoulder these burdens. And thanks.
I want to also light a candle of joy for connections here, and just while I'm doing this, pass on some news that I got. Jenny Norris is in a rehab center in Massachusetts. She had fallen before she left to go to Massachusetts, and they decided that would be the best place to evaluate what she needs. And I meant to bring her phone number in case there's anybody who wants to call her, because she's dying for connections back here. Okay. And the other piece of this has been an enormously stressful couple of weeks for me, just because there's things coming in different directions from work and the fellowship. But then there's some things that are so restoring, like singing in the choir. And the other one is the Sunday morning discussion group we have, which has been sort of limping along. We're going to meet this afternoon right after coffee in the nursery, I think, if anybody's interested in joining us.
Not to harp on thanking the Clarks, but Graham gave a marvelous concert yesterday, donated all the proceeds, brought in a lot of people to this, and that family has helped enlarge this community for me, and I think for all of us, to just make it a bigger and happier place.
I'm Donna Moriarty. I want to light this candle for Gail Hudson, who's not here, I don't think, because she's probably getting ready for another performance of Out Loud, a play that she wrote and is directing. My daughter Amanda has a part in it, and this play, I've seen it 4 times now. It's really, no, I don't do this with all of them. It's a really, really powerful play. It brings, I don't want to go on and on about the play, but just I'm so moved that Gail would bring something like this to life and that she would have spotted my daughter, who had almost no sort of experience in theater. And it has, I'm not kidding when I say it has transformed her to be in this play. It's an important play. If you haven't seen it, I know a lot of you have, talk to me afterwards. I'll tell you how you can still get tickets.
I'm going to actually light a couple of candles this morning. I'd like to light this first candle in celebration of my newly ordained colleague, Reverend Rebecca Sala, and this congregation's wonderful choir, and how many people came last week to Stanford. That was inspiring. And I'm going to light this second candle, because I understand there are 3 of our congregants on a 100-mile bicycle ride today. And so around this county, and they are doing it for a number of reasons, but it is also raising some money for a cause of helpfulness to those who are in need. Here we go with a final candle. For those stirrings to life, those yearnings of wholeness and holiness, those joys and sorrows that have not yet found their way into a voice that we can share aloud, may we hold all of those deeply in our heart. Let us enter into a time of deepening with the words of L. Annie Forrester this morning, And then we will have some silence and then a musical meditation. I invite you to join me in whatever spirit moves you to a time of deepening. Spirit of ages, light of life, what can we tell you that is not already known? What can we ask for that will not come without asking? And still we speak to tell, to ask, to pray. We would tell of our triumphs in order to drown out the shout of our defeats. We would tell of our love in order to still the fear that we are unloved. And we would tell of our lives as if to live forever. We would ask for wisdom and will settle for the courage to do what we must. We would ask for joy and will be grateful for the ability to cry. And we would ask for one another's continued presence and will be content with memories and dreams. Thus we tell, and thus we ask, and thus we pray, giving thanks for what has been, accepting what is, and yearning with hope and determination for what will be. Let us sit for a few moments in silence and then with music as we seek to encounter a deepness within our own soul. And now, with some music. Thank you. This is the morning for stories. This is called Attached or Committed. It's from Rachel Naomi Remen, Kitchen Table Wisdom. 35 years ago, I had as a patient a young man who had become separated from his ski party and spent 3 days in below zero weather, yet somehow had managed to survive. He had been hospitalized for several days in the ski country and then flown to our center in New York because of frostbite and progressive gangrene of his feet. The local surgeons in the ski country had wanted to amputate, and it was hoped that our world-renowned vascular surgical team could avoid this difficult choice. He had some initial surgery, and for 3 weeks the outcome was not clear. Then his left foot began to improve, and his right foot became steadily worse. The time for amputation at hand, the young man flatly refused. He preferred to keep his foot. Gradually, he became sicker and sicker as the toxins from his injured foot began to flood his body. His family and friends were desperate, but he would not be moved. He would keep his foot. The situation came to a head late one evening when, for the third or fourth time, a group of doctors shared his most recent laboratory studies and reviewed his worsening condition with him. In the midst of this discussion, his fiancée, overwhelmed by the possibility of her beloved's death, was driven beyond her endurance. Weeping, she tore his engagement ring off her finger and thrust it onto the swollen black little toe of his right foot. "I hate this damn foot," she sobbed. "If you want this foot so much, why don't you marry it? You're going to have to choose. You can't have us both." We all looked at the small, bright diamond surrounded by the black and rotting tissue of his foot. Even under the sparkling fluorescent lights, it sparkled with life. The young man said nothing and closed his eyes with weariness. Weary ourselves, we left to continue the medical rounds. The next morning, he scheduled his surgery. More to come. Every Sunday morning, when this congregation gathers, the following words are spoken. Love is the doctrine of this fellowship. The quest for truth is its sacrament and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, to serve humanity in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow into harmony. Thus, do we covenant with one another? Covenant has a long history. And in this religious tradition, that history begins with the Bible. It begins with the first covenant in Genesis 8:21-22 with Noah. After the earth has been flooded, "I will never again curse the ground because of humankind, nor will I ever again destroy every living creature as I have done. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease." That is the very first covenant, understood to be a covenant between God
and humanity. It is the covenant that lies at the base of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. The next biblical covenant happens in Genesis 22:17 to 18, the story of Abraham when he is asked to sacrifice his son Isaac, and then Isaac is spared. And I will spare you the reading since it didn't open there. And that covenant is understood at the base of Judaism and Christianity, though let me tell you, it is understood very differently between Judaism and Christianity. Within that same story is the birth of Ishmael, who is at the base of the Islamic understanding of covenant with God. It goes on, the next covenant is that with Moses in Deuteronomy. And I will read this because it did open to this one. The Lord our God made a covenant with us at Horeb. Not with our ancestors did the Lord make this covenant, but with us, who are all of us here alive today. And that is still understood among Jews to be a covenant with those who are still alive today. And the next major covenant in the biblical tradition was the covenant of Jesus, understood to be a new covenant, a covenant which superseded only the law as a way of understanding and spoke to a larger covenant with God having to do with love. That's a Christian understanding. Jews understand that covenant to also be about love. But the way the New Testament Christians first saw that. The covenant made between God and people was understood to be a sacred promise, like but not a contract, something which would bind our hearts and our love, and in the biblical understanding, God's heart and God's love, to something greater than any single individual, to something greater than humanity. We say today, in this time, we covenant. We understand ourselves, I believe, but I speak for you, perhaps not correctly, to make a sacred promise, to bind our hearts to something greater than ourselves, greater than our individual congregations, but something which can come alive within the context of ourselves and our congregations and our being together as a faith community. These covenants that began in the Bible, we can jump forward to the 1600s to trace the history of our agreement to convene and covenant together. This comes from some words by the Reverend Alice Blair Wesley, who spoke a great deal about covenant during some lectures she wrote, called The Lay and Liberal Doctrine of the Church, The Spirit and Promise of Our Covenant. The first one of these six lectures she actually gave at our Unitarian Universalist congregation in Dedham, Massachusetts. And she writes for that very first one, I sought your invitation to give the first of this year's series of lectures here at First Church Dedham. I thank you for your kindness. And I hope you will come to understand why I so much wanted to begin in Dedham. It is because of a very quiet little event, of long, still living, tradition-shaping consequence that happened here among a small group of ancestors of today's Unitarian Universalists in 1637. This quiet little event, she goes on to say, was meant to lead to the founding of the Dedham Church. It did. Moreover, it led to the founding in 1638 of a particular kind of free church, having distinct features very characteristic of other free churches already founded and soon to be founded all over the region by the 20,000 or so colonists who came to New England by the shipload in the decade of the 1630s, specifically for the purpose of founding just these kind of free churches. Not everything that happened here in New England in the 1600s was but one fruit of a great sprawling complex of many earlier and continuing events elsewhere in the 1500s and 1600s. These events involve much war, much noise, I believe a lot of confused politics, and everywhere varying amounts of violence, even unto international war. I mean that vast complex of many events known as the Protestant Reformation, she continues. But I want to focus on the long meanings of this one small tradition-shaping event way over on the left wing of the Reformation, as those meanings may be understood to have a bearing now in our congregations in this year, 2005, though she wrote this in 2001, on all the liberal Unitarian Universalist congregations of North America. And I'm going to skip over a great deal of what she says to go forward. Now I want to tell you what happened in Dedham in 1637 before the founding of the church, in the same church whose building where she was preaching in that year. The story is recorded in the church records, now kept in the archives of the Dedham Historical Society. By 1637, there were 30 families in Dedham, all very recently settled there. They had come from various parts of England. Some families had even lived for a while since they came from different ships in a variety of New England towns until the general court said people of these 30 or so families could have a portion of land in a township that came to be named Dedham. Upon reaching this piece of American wilderness, they first had to design a town government. So they decided how to legally allot fields for growing crops and smaller lots for building houses. And she goes on to talk about how they built their houses and began to grow their crops until there came to be a time when they began to gather for greater purposes. She says, one might even think of them as suburbanites. And that they had to begin by starting to talk with strangers, their neighbors, people who might be like themselves religiously, but they did not know each other in any depth. So they adopted a few simple rules for their meetings, she goes on to say. Rule one, they would decide before leaving each meeting what question to discuss at the next meeting. Rule two, that way people were more apt to consider and share their considered thoughts. Rule two, each week the host of the house would begin speaking to the agreed upon question. Then everyone else could speak by turns. All individuals could, as they choose, speak to the question or raise a closely related question and speak to that or state any objections or doubts concerning what any others had said. And here's a quote from their original words. So it were humbly and with a teachable heart, not with any mind of caviling or contradicting. In other words, Rule 3 said, here we speak our own misunderstandings or doubts. No arguing. The record reports that all their reasonings were very peaceable, loving, and tender, much to edification. Alice Blair Wesley goes on to account how they did this for a year. And as I was reading her accounts, I remembered reading the accounts of this fellowship's early beginnings, where people met every week for the purpose of edification. The language, though 300 years apart, is not all that different, oddly enough. It was very interesting. And they met for a year, and at the end of a year, they began to edge toward talk about a church, and for them it was a church. They understood themselves to be Christians. Their first question on this subject was, here we are not presently members of any church. We don't know each other well religiously. Are we qualified to assemble together and confer like this? That was a question. Their answer, we are if, in the judgment of charity, and those are the original words, we seem to be and think we are acting out of genuinely deep religious love. Now, I don't want to mislead here, Alice Blair Wesley goes on. For these Dedham people, genuinely deep religious love meant a union with Christ. That's how they understood it. And she goes on to say, but for now, I will just say that I am convinced that what they meant by that term generally was no different than what we mean by a phrase like genuinely deep religious love. Love is the doctrine of this fellowship. The next question, she goes on to say, well, if we can meet like this just as neighbors, isn't this enough? Maybe we don't need a church. Their answer was, no, this is too casual. If we want to live in the ways of our deepest love, then we must intentionally form a much deeper community of love. Thus, and these are quotes from their words with some updating of language, I think she's done. The spiritual condition of even deeply loving people is such as stand in need of all instituted helps for the repair of the spirit and edification of the whole body of, and they called it the church. We would say the community. And besides, they felt, she goes on to say, others in the larger society need the example of love, which a free church will publicly show forth. Otherwise, others might not be drawn to the life of effective love or enjoy the benefits of justice, peace, and so on in civil society, which the free church will care about and speak out for. My point here, she says, is they understood the role of the church, or the congregation as we could understand it, as filling both the needs of the members and the larger community. And I'll end with these words of hers. These lay people's central conclusion from all these weeks of discussion was this: members of their new free church should be joined in a covenant of religious loyalty to the spirit of love. And once the members were joined in a covenant of their own writing and signing, the members' loyalty in the church should only be to the spirit of love, working in their own hearts and minds. Thus do we covenant with one another. Love, writes James Luther Adams, a Unitarian Universalist theologian of this century, love is that which inspires our mutual loyalties. It is that to which we owe our mutual loyalty. It is something deep. We cannot use reason alone, he says, for this reason. The world has many educated people who know how to reason, and they reason very well. But curiously enough, many of them fail to examine the pre-established premises from which they reason, premises that can turn on examination to be antisocial, protective camouflages of power. Where our treasure is, there will be our heart also, and where our heart is, there will be our reason and our premises. The theoretical attitude of distance needs for its completion, the existential attitude of decision. St. Paul, Adam says, underlines this fact when he speaks of the foolishness of the wise. The element of conflict inherent in us and in human relations with our neighbors can be dealt with only by a regenerative will, a will committed to the principles of liberty and justice and love, a will prepared by a faith, a decision, a commitment sufficient to cope with the principalities and powers of the world. Love is the doctrine of this church. Thus do we covenant. A covenant requires discipline. It requires more than just reason. Like Jewish halakha, we need a discipline in the service of our covenant, in the service of the deeper love. For each of us in Unitarian Universalism, we find that discipline in many different places. For some of us, it is the practice of Buddhist meditation. For others, it may be in prayer. For others, it is in the wonderings of science and the deeper questions about the nature and mystery of life and time spent devoted to studying that. There are many I haven't even begun to say, which you may speak to yourselves. A covenant to be worthy must be larger than just an attachment to a community, to a particular fellowship, to our individual growth and needs. A covenant must call us to ask, what are our worthiest loves and what do they require of us in our day-to-day lives? I'm going to end with the rest of the story about attached or committed. She goes on to say that she continued to follow this man through the fitting of his artificial foot and his rehabilitation. And at the end of a year, only a slight limp marked his difficult choice. 2 weeks before his wedding, asking him what had changed his mind, he said that seeing the diamond on his toe had shocked him. His fiancée had been right. He had been married to his foot. Her dramatic gesture had helped him to see for the first time that he was more attached to keeping his foot than he was committed to his life and to their life together. Yet it had been the promise of that life that he had clung to that had enabled him to survive those 3 days in the snow alone. While attachment has its source in the personality, in what the Buddhists refer to as the desire nature of the soul, in relationship to life, just as in human relationships, attachment closes down options. Commitment opens them up. Modern life has made us people of attachment rather than people of commitment. Indeed, many people have found it difficult to tell the difference between attachment and commitment in their own lives. Yet attachment leads farther and farther into entrapment, and commitment, though it may sometimes feel constricting, will ultimately lead to greater degrees of freedom. Both involve, in the moment, an experience of holding, sometimes against the flow of events or against temptation. One can distinguish between the two in most situations by noticing over time whether one is moved through this activity or this relationship closer to freedom or closer to bondage. Attachment is a reflex, an automatic response, which often may not reflect our deepest good. Commitment
is a conscious choice to align ourselves with the most genuine values and our sense of purpose. Survival in a setting of life-threatening illness may involve a willingness to let go of everything but life itself. I know we've run quite late this morning. I will offer a time of brief sharing to ask if any would like to share their own witness to how their experience of this covenant of love being the doctrine of this fellowship and a sense of covenanting has inspired or in some way informed your own lives. Ed, can I call upon you for a microphone?
My observation is really quite simple, but I think maybe the greatest covenant that I feel here is a commitment to generosity, and that is what continues to inspire me to do more, to think more of the greater world, and I find that here, maybe more than in the rest of my community.
Thank you.
That was such a good sermon. You're probably getting a lot of people sitting here really thinking deeply about it. I've been struggling over the years to distinguish between attachment and commitment and covenant in my relationship to this community. There are times when, like many of us, I think, you know, that's just too much stuff. I just can't handle that. Okay, I just can't handle that anymore. But by thinking about what is it that I'm really, what do I think is really valuable and where shall I put my time, I've done things and encountered things that I think gave me so much back. And I gave a little advertisement for the discussion group this morning, but really it's activities like that that I think enrich my covenant with this community, the things that really do carry out my deepest values and I think the values of the community. So that's where I've been struggling, you know, where should I put my time and where does it mean something?
I will ask you to rise in body and spirit and remain standing for our final hymn, our closing words, and our chalice extinguishing. And the choir is going to help us with our closing hymn. I know we've been here a while, but let's put our entire spirit and sense of covenant and commitment into this one. Let us sing.
of our heart, sing us into a faithfulness with our commitment to what is life-giving each time possibilities arise and we are blessed with an opportunity to choose again. Go in peace. Blessed be. Shall we sing? Last week we sang Carry the Flame. Join in, you'll learn, it will come. Carry the flame of peace and love until we meet again. The service is ended. Go in peace.